Whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Hi, I'm Rachel Fraser. I'm an associate professor of philosophy at Oxford, and I teach at Exeter College, Oxford. I work mainly on epistemology, though I have interests almost pretty much across the board in philosophy. But in particular, I'm interested in issues in aesthetics, philosophy of language, and sort of social and political philosophy, particularly feminist philosophy.
Well, I want to ask you about a dimension of your work that might be of special interest to listeners. So that you've also written a range of sort of essays in public philosophy, sort of general audience things, especially. I encourage people to check out your essays at the Cambridge Humanities Review, which are really amazing. I mean, do you have a kind of vision of the relationship between the more public-facing work you're doing and your more academic work? Are they sort of continuous? Do they contrast? I'm kind of curious about how you think about that.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything like very insightful or interesting to say here. I certainly don't have any kind of neat story about how they interact. I suppose, I mean, this may be a sort of preempting a bit some of the stuff that we might get into with the question about temperament, right? The question about how temperament influences your philosophy. But I think one of the things that, you know, I think a lot of people feel this way, right, about professional philosophy and its kind of recent incarnations is there are lots of things that are amazing and wonderful and sort of stimulating and demanding about philosophy and its current kind of institutional articulation. But, you know, it does privilege a certain kind of narrowness. It can be very dry. And so I guess that's one of the things I like about this more sort of public writing is that you can be a bit less narrow, you can be a bit more, I guess in a certain way, sort of imaginative, right? Like, you know, your ideas don't need to be worked out with the same degree of precision. They don't need to be so readily translatable into a particular kind of logicese for them to sort of be appropriate, venue appropriate. So I think I find that kind of more open-endedness, kind of open texture. I guess I would say like that sort of writing feels more open to a certain kind of like open textured, imaginative thinking that it's difficult to sort of do if you want to, you know, publish in journals, which is not to, you know, shit on journals. I think they, you know, they're really valuable, but they're not like the only kind of philosophical work that I think many people find valuable, myself included.
Yeah, I mean, I love that sort of sense of playfulness that public writing can sometimes have, that often philosophers in conversation have, even in like the colloquium Q&A they will have, but doesn't show up in academic writing so much. It sounds like the way you're thinking about it, they're sort of two separate enterprises. It's not that you're tempted to write in your academic works the way you do when you're writing for a wider audience and sort of have that aspiration for the future. You're happy with them being two different projects.
Yeah, I think actually extremely happy with them being two different projects. If anything, I would say actually my experience of sort of having to write extremely kind of clipped philosophical prose has really helped me with my sort of less academically focused writing. Sort of I go back and read things that I read in my early 20s and it's just, they're so flowery, they're so ornate, there is just, the tendency is towards just something kind of ridiculously over the top, or it seems ridiculously over the top now, you know, sort of like every sentence has some sort of overwrought image or metaphor in it. And I think that the experience of, yeah, having to write this very sort of disciplining process of writing philosophical prose has actually been like very stylistically helpful for me. It's made me much less sort of inclined towards that sort of, and I now think a sort of slightly embarrassing floweriness that I was guilty of maybe 10 years ago in most of my writing.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I know that mode, the sort of very self-conscious, I am now a writing creatively mode, where you think I must somehow, it must show up in the sentence that this is somehow creative, and it can be very forced.
I think the embarrassing thing is it's just sort of never felt forced for me. It was really how I sort of wanted to write, or just in this kind of, yeah, very overly stylized way.
Well, I'm going to resist the temptation to ask you more questions about this, and in particular about its relation to Iris Murdoch, who has a kind of interesting, complicated relationship herself to literary writing, creative writing, and philosophical writing, and just go straight to the official question inspired by Murdoch, who begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but who also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. So would you say your temperament influences your philosophy, and if so, how?
Yeah, I think there are sort of two main ways that I can say, I could give a yes answer to this question. So the first is, I mean, I think you already observed that I write about a lot of different things. So I think that's kind of the big way in which my temperament influences my philosophical work is that, yeah, I write about a lot of different things. And I think this is just because I am extremely easily bored. And sort of very prone to kind of getting distracted by sort of shiny new things. So one of the things I find most challenging about sort of being an academic philosopher is I don't think, you know, when I was sort of considering applying to grad school, for example, I don't think I had any real sense of how long it takes to complete, you know, a paper. I don't think I had any sense of how much of a commitment it is to go from like having the sort of, you know, idea for a paper to getting it published. I had no clue that it was going to take so long. And I think the bit about academic work that I really love is and I think this is not totally unusual, but the thing I really love, the thing that I really value in academia is really the moment at which you sort of have the exciting new idea. And I find the process of having to kind of package that idea in a way that makes other people sympathetic to the idea much less interesting. So that's I think, one way in which my temperament definitely influences the kind of philosophical work I do.
Well, before you talk about the other way in which your temperament influences your philosophy, I have a question about that. I mean, I have this sense, too, that there's the excitement of learning and figuring things out, and then the painfulness of trying to put it in a form that is accessible to even possibly persuasive to others. Are you ever tempted to just stop doing that? Just think about philosophy and not write academic?
Maybe I'll be so tempted once I have tenure.
I see.
But I suspect not, because, I mean, my experience of this kind of painful process of trying to make one's ideas kind of intelligible to others is, you know, it is a process where, you know, there's one side of things where it's like, you know, you send a paper out for review and there's a kind of incredibly sort of captious or irritating reviewer comment that you have to respond to, which just seems absurd. But, you know, that's sort of one end of the spectrum. There's a lot of the project of trying to sort of figure out how to make one's idea intelligible to others that is, I think, fairly indistinguishable from the project of actually trying to make it properly intelligible to yourself, right? So I think I'm definitely someone who figures out what they actually think through the project of writing it and trying to make it intelligible to others. So I fear that if I stopped trying to write philosophy, that would be to stop thinking about philosophy for me, just because the two projects are just so intimately tied up with each other. I very often feel like I didn't really know what I thought about something. Even if I will look back and I'll be like, oh yeah, I thought I'd figured out what I thought about that, but I really hadn't, not until I tried to write it down in a way that would, you know, make it intelligible to other people.
Got it. No, that makes a lot of sense. No, I sometimes wonder about whether I'm like that or not, because, or whether it's just laziness that I sometimes feel like I don't want to have to write it out for others. But what was the second aspect of your temperament that influences your philosophical work?
I think the kind of thing I'm interested in. So, I mean, two of my major philosophical preoccupations are these kind of aesthetically rich forms of language. So metaphor and narrative are both things that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And I think that my interest in those topics is very much like the fruit of a particular kind of temperament. You know, the thing I can remember being concerned about sort of intellectually, the thing that I've always been puzzled about is sort of language and aesthetically rich forms of language in particular. Things like, what is going on with a novel? How does a novel manage to communicate or disclose something about the world? I mean, not exactly in those terms, obviously, but something like that has bothered me really as long as I can remember. As long as I've sort of read books, I've had these kinds of concerns. So I think that the philosophical interests I have are, to a large extent, a product of that kind of very long-running, temperamentally rooted concern.
But that's interesting. I mean, those are not topics, or that's not a sort of orientation that is especially widespread in analytic philosophy. I mean, did that draw you away from philosophy, or do you feel like there's a kind of friction between that kind of interest in language and narrative and metaphor and the persona of the analytic philosopher?
Yeah, so I kind of ended up in philosophy by accident, because if I'd been left to my own devices as a teenager, I would have definitely applied to do English literature at university, but I did not. My family were very much, you need to do a degree that you can get a job of at the end of, kind of thing. So they wanted me to apply to university to do something that was kind of employable, basically. And I didn't mind, I really liked science. I especially liked physics at school. So I actually applied to Oxford to do physics and philosophy. So I applied everywhere to do physics. At Oxford, you could do physics and philosophy. So I was like, oh, great. I can sort of, you know, do the employable thing, but also, you know, dabble in philosophy on the side. So, you know, there was no physics and English degree. If there were, I would probably have applied for that instead. And it became clear fairly early on that I was just much more interested in philosophy than I was in physics. Hence why I ended up in philosophy. But it's interesting. The question of whether I feel sort of alienated by analytic philosophy. And I think the answer is no. I think partly because, you know, especially with something like metaphor, for example, there's actually a really rich tradition of thinking about metaphor in analytic philosophy. I think there's this kind of picture of analytic philosophy sometimes that maybe overlooks its kind of historical connection to these topics of more sort of humanistic concern. But also, I think that my style of thinking is just extremely analytic. There's a sort of wonderful like anecdote that Naomi Scheman tells about sort of, I think, sitting in her first philosophy classroom and feeling like she was hearing her native language spoken for the first time. That's exactly how I felt when I came to analytic philosophy. I was like, oh my goodness, there are other people whose minds work this way. So although the topics I'm interested in perhaps are not sort of classic analytic topics, the ways of thinking about or the ways of like puzzling through those topics that I find productive is very analytic. And I think that combination is quite an interesting one.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I mean, I have to say, when you said your parents wanted you to do something that was employable, and it ended up with you doing philosophy, I was curious about how they thought. I was glad that they thought philosophy was a highly employable skill, but I guess physics was the intermediary that got you there.
Right, physics was a compromise. Physics was a compromise. Really, engineering or medicine were the top choices. So physics was already a compromise from engineering.
Well, I'm going to ask you question two, which is about philosophy in your life as well. So, has philosophy ever helped you out of a practical or emotional difficulty in your life?
Right. So the first thing to say is I'm just sort of to give a little bit of a content warning here. I'm going to be talking about rape and sexual assault. So just to flag that for any listeners for whom having that content warning is important. The first thing that struck me when I was thinking about this question was that there's something kind of interesting about its framing. So the question says, has philosophy ever helped you out with a practical or emotional difficulty. And one thing that really struck me about this was that the framing of the question seems to suggest something like, well, there's a kind of like default, morally neutral sort of equilibrium, like life as normal. And then some event sort of plunges in from the outside. The equilibrium is disrupted and the project is restoring equilibrium. Or at least this was very much how I was thinking about the question. I was trying to think if philosophy had ever helped me kind of restore equilibrium when one of these external events had sort of disrupted my life as normal. And the thing that came to mind when I was thinking about the question in this way is I had an extremely traumatic sexual experience when I was in my late teens. And I spent a long time trying to work out whether I should think of what happened as rape. I spent a long time trying to figure out whether the concept of rape was the right fit for what I had gone through. And I found philosophy really invaluable in making it clearer to me sort of what was at stake in that question or why I cared about the answer to that question. And I think probably where I am now is that I'm not especially concerned about whether rape is the right label for what happened. But I think that kind of is a kind of cultivated ambivalence or indifference to a certain kind of label, I think is something I've only really been able to reach due to a sort of way of thinking about concepts and the purpose of concepts, which philosophy has made available to me. So that's one thing I think that philosophy has really helped me with.
So could you say more about what, when you were thinking sort of early on that there was a lot at stake in whether this was rape, and philosophy sort of gave you a way to make sense of that. What initially seemed to be at stake, and how did philosophy come to grips with that?
Right. So I guess what I was interested in really was whether a certain bundle of affective and normative responses to this event were legitimate, right? So I wanted to know how to feel. I wanted to know what the appropriate or legitimate affective responses to this event were. And I also wanted to know what kind of affective responses were the correct ones, the apt ones. And I wanted to know what kinds of more broadly reactive attitudes were the correct ones to have.
Yeah.
I wanted to know whether I should feel wronged or whether I ought to blame the person I had this experience with or the extent to which I could hold them accountable. I suppose those were the kinds of things I was interested in. Though I didn't have, of course, when this happened, I didn't have that language available to articulate what I was after.
And you said that sort of eventually you reached a point where the question of how to describe it didn't seem to have the kind of weight it had had at that point. Again, just, I was curious about why that happened and how philosophy informed that.
I guess to some extent it informed it because I came to think of concepts as capable of doing much less work than maybe I had initially thought. I guess there's a way of thinking about concepts in which they kind of have this magic power almost, you know? So when I was doing my DPhil, I worked as a rape crisis line worker for about 4 years. And, you know, I spoke to many people who were grappling with exactly the same question I had grappled with, you know, the question of whether they ought to call the thing that happened to them rape. And for almost everyone I spoke to, it was this kind of enormously consequential decision, you know, deciding to call it that would have this tremendous kind of normative weight. Sometimes that normative weight would be a relief, right? Sometimes the normative weight would be a tremendous relief because calling it rape would be a way of legitimizing the terrible effects that this event had had on this person's life. Other times, you know, calling what happened rape would be unbearable in various ways, because it would mean the destruction of a particular kind of interpersonal relationship, or it would make the person who had experienced the sexual assault feel sort of sullied in some way. But I suppose what I came to think was going on with these kinds of questions was, or here's a different way of approaching sort of where I landed. The thought is just like, okay, well, what is the concept of rape? We want the concept of rape to do a particular kind of work for us, a particular kind of practical and normative work. Part of what it is to call something rape is to legitimize or demand a certain set of kind of normative and affective responses. And I suppose I just came to think that these tools are inevitably imperfect, you know?
Yeah.
Even the best possible concept of rape is never going to be capable of sort of capturing the nuance, as it were, of every person's experience of sexual violence. And so it just seemed to me to be less consequential whether this kind of counted as an instance of rape, because that was sort of, the question was something like, does an imperfect tool properly describe my experience? And that just came to seem like a much less interesting question than the question of what sorts of affective and normative responses to this event are apt, right? It became clear to me that I could ask that question directly without these questions being conceptually mediated by this notion of rape.
This is incredibly powerful. I mean, I think it connects both, it's both continuous with a sort of Murdochian idea that how we describe things matters, and a kind of critique of that idea. I mean, there's also, I'm sort of also moved, I think, by the critique of the question that you opened with, which is, it's true that asking if philosophy has helped you out of a practical or emotional difficulty suggests this picture of a kind of neutral equilibrium that we have to return to, and philosophy can sometimes do it. And the truth is, now that you've drawn my attention to that, I don't think of life that way. I think of it as basically a constant struggle. There's no getting out of the practical or emotional difficulties. They're there all the time. Philosophy might help you in the ongoing struggle with them, but it wouldn't get you out of them. There's no getting out. Well, so
right. I wanted to say something else about that framing, actually, which was I thought the example involving the rape was kind of one example, but then I was also thinking just more generally about what I think feminist philosophy has done for me, or feminist theory more broadly, maybe, where there is this potential in something like feminist theory, I think, to completely alter one's relationship to that sort of background state, right? Or even to make you see that it's not a kind of stable, morally neutral equilibrium, but rather to bring about a different form of consciousness, so that your sort of like default orientation to the world is altered. And I think that's probably what feminist theory did for me in my early 20s. So there wasn't a sort of particular problem, a sort of relatively self-contained problem that I was facing that philosophy or theory helped me with, but rather there was a whole condition or form of life to which that kind of theory altered my relationship.
Well, there is a kind of transition here from talking about consciousness raising and changes of view to question three. Have you ever changed your mind about a major philosophical question? And if so, how?
Yeah, I changed my mind about quite a lot of philosophical questions. Though I guess one of the things that I was thinking about when I was thinking about this question was, I mean, I still think of myself basically as a child philosophically, but I'm a bit more philosophically mature than I was when I was 18 or so. And, you know, I had philosophical views at 18 when I'd never really done philosophy. So I changed my mind, I think, about a lot of things early on, right? So, I mean, the big one is I changed my mind about the permissibility of abortion. I thought abortion was morally impermissible. And then I read Judith Jarvis Thompson's paper when I was 18, and I was like, right, I'm persuaded it's morally permissible. So that was a big one. And I've also, I guess the other sort of big thing I've changed my mind on that's a sort of self-contained philosophical question is the metaphysics of personal identity. I am now a fairly committed animalist. I didn't used to be an animalist, but I think reading Judith Jarvis Thompson was crucial to this transition. So she's definitely the philosopher who's changed my mind about more things than anyone else.
You know, it's animalism is a funny one. I'm not sure if this has come up on the podcast before. There are questions about exactly what it means to say that we're animals, and you know, the details are complicated. But the personal identity debate is strange because it's one of those areas where, in most areas of philosophy, philosophers are pretty commonsensical. Like, skepticism about the external world is a minority view. Most people treat arguments for skepticism as problems to be addressed rather than things where you just accept the conclusion. And in the case of personal identity, philosophers, even sort of very commonsensical philosophers in most respects, hold views that from the point of view of you know, enlightened common sense, on which we're, you know, we're Homo sapiens, we're a certain kind of animal, are just all over the place. It's very, I've never really understood how exactly the philosophy of personal identity came to be such a sort of battleground of bizarre views in which the sort of obvious answer is just regarded as sort of one curious option among many. I don't know. Do you have a story about how you ended up, like, what was the initial appeal of not being an animalist? What was the sort of view you took before then?
I'm not even really sure I had one, to be honest. I think this is one area in which I'm actually kind of tempted by a very kind of vulgar ideology critique, as it were, where I think there's really, and this is partly just reflecting on my own autobiography, and also I think often the responses of students when I teach personal identity, especially women, I think there's often this deep resistance to animalism because the idea of thinking of oneself as an animal seems to have an array of unpalatable consequences, right? I mean, certainly my whole adolescence really was kind of this desperate struggle to escape the what seemed to me the terrible burden of being sort of embodied as a woman.
Right.
And so, you know, part of the attraction of philosophy was that one could escape this. And then you come to philosophy and then somebody tells you you're an animal and you're like, no, of course I'm not an animal. I'm here because I'm trying to transcend my animal nature, which of course one can't. And I mean, perhaps this is just very autobiographically revealing, but I suspect I'm not completely idiosyncratic in this regard. I suspect that for a lot of people who are philosophically inclined, there just is some kind of deep strangeness in thinking of oneself as an animal.
Well, I'm going to swerve away from philosophy a little bit for question four to other modes of expression and ask, is there a work of art that you love in part for its philosophical depth?
This is such an interesting question. And I find myself in classic philosopher mode getting really hung up on the notion of philosophical depth.
Yeah.
I guess sort of putting that to one side and being like, okay, like, you know sort of what Kieran's getting at. I guess the other thing that was sort of tripping me up when trying to think about how to answer this question as well is that there's one way of approaching this question which treats works of art kind of as sort of complicated codes that need cracked, right? So there's a kind of visual language, say, and you just need to kind of learn what all the symbols mean and you'll be able to decipher the philosophical content that the painting is kind of presenting to you, which I find a very odd way of thinking, at least about things like music and visual art. I guess something that kept coming back to me as a work of art, I don't know if it has philosophical depth, but let's say it's a work of art that appeals to the philosopher in me, is that John Cage's Solo for Sliding Trombone.
Okay, I don't know it.
It's great, and you should, you can't just listen to it, you need to sort of watch a video of the performance.
Okay.
It's a performance where the trombone is kind of played and noise is produced from it in a whole variety of ways. So for example, the trombone is kind of hit as well as sort of played in the traditional way. And it's also kind of dismantled in various ways throughout the performance.
Wow.
So it's extremely funny. It's just, it's very funny. It's extremely playful. But it's also kind of clearly kind of playing with the arbitrariness and sort of artificiality and stuffiness of various kinds of, you know, the conventions of performance. But I think also makes sort of contingency or fragility kind of amusing or funny. So it's kind of a deeply comic work of art, I think, in a way that it's, I think that's kind of, it's very difficult to do something that is funny but also deep, right? Is a sort of attempt to kind of reconcile you to your own contingency and absurdity. And I think Solo for Sliding Trombone comes close to managing to do that. It manages to kind of make one's own contingency and artificiality and constructiveness visible and comic.
Well, I should listen to it and watch it. I have a soft spot for dark comedy or comedy that makes difficult things, that sort of changes the way you relate to difficult things. I mean, there are occasionally funny bits of philosophy. I think comedy and philosophy are sort of, there aren't that many philosophers who are funny in a way that's actually important to their philosophy, as opposed to just on the side. And I think that's sort of, that's sad in a way, at least of contemporary philosophers. I feel like there's this kind of untapped possibility of drawing out the absurdity and comedy of a lot of what philosophy, a lot of what philosophers do.
One of my colleagues says that this is something she really tries to get across to her students, which is just the extent to which philosophy will make you sound ridiculous.
Yes.
You know, you're saying things that sound kind of ridiculous on the face of it, or considering scenarios which are absurd, and kind of trying to kind of cultivate a taste for philosophy in her students by drawing attention to this kind of comic aspect of it, which I think is a very sort of pedagogically interesting approach.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot. Well, from comedy and lightness to darkness, we're going to end with question five, another Murdoch quote. "It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher," she wrote. "What is she afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
I mean, I'm afraid of all the normal things like illness and death and people I love suffering. But I suppose the question is like a bit more about like, what are you afraid of that maybe not everyone is afraid of? And what I'm afraid of, this is very embarrassing. I think one of the things I'm most afraid of is seeming stupid. I told my partner that that was going to be my answer, and he was like, "Wow, that's very honest." But yeah, I'm very afraid of seeming stupid or coming across as stupid, especially in professional contexts.
I mean, I am too, although I think I'm getting over it after 25 years in philosophy a little bit. But do you find it empowering? Does it motivate you? Can you make something good out of it, or is it just inhibiting?
I think in various ways it's actually been extremely useful to me. You know, partly it's like, I think, yeah, I'm scared of seeming stupid, but also being a young woman in philosophy, people do think you're stupid a lot. So there is a sort of genuine, there is a kind of genuine thing that you have to struggle against there. So, you know, when I was a grad student, and even I still do this sometimes now, you know, is if I've got a question in a Q&A session, I would like write the question down. So that I could sort of basically just read the question out. And I think this was really helpful, actually, like partly because it allowed me to ask questions when I would have been too nervous to do so otherwise, because I wasn't sort of terrified that I'd completely, my mind would go completely blank in the middle of the question and sort of look idiotic. But also, I think it made my questions sharp and precise, whereas very often, you know, people will have these big, long, rambling questions in a Q&A, which are sometimes very interesting, but often are just a little self-indulgent or whatever. So I think that that actually made me better at formulating and asking good questions in Q&A. I think that's just like a good thing to be good at, but was also probably professionally helpful insofar as seeming like the sort of person who can ask good questions is something that is valued in our field. So yeah, that was a kind of, I guess, a sort of small way in which the fear, I think, was helpful in sort of cultivating a particular kind of professionally valuable and intellectually valuable skill.
Well, I'm delighted to end with an actual practical tip that listeners can use and say, Thank you, Rachel, so much for appearing on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Rachel Fraser is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Oxford and Michael Cohen Fellow in Philosophy at Exeter College. She's the author of Narrative Testimony, The Ethics of Metaphor, and Other Essays in Philosophy. Thanks for listening to 5 Questions. Mm-hmm.